to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your hostess with the mostest, El Ariel, and we can be found at lariel.music.com/podcasts or musicjobspodcast.com. So here we are. We are at episode 3 of season 2, or if you want to be technical about it, episode 69, and doing fine. So I'm going to let you guys get right to the interview with the amazing Dr. Susan Rogers. I am not going to keep babbling away, but I just want you to prepare yourself for this amazing journey. This is someone who had to drop out of high school, was married at 17, and yet by her mid-20s, she was the staff engineer for Prince, working by his side, creating the iconic, legendary Purple Rain album, and went on to have a very illustrious career in the music industry, and then left the industry, went to academia, got her PhD in psychology, is now teaching at the Berklee College of Music, and is an expert in psychoacoustics. So, one hell of a road, and you're going to hear all about it starting now. Hi, Susan. Welcome to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Hi, Ariel. It's nice to be here, and thank you for having me on your program.
Absolutely. Tell me your earliest memories of music.
Being a little kid in Southern California, I grew up in Anaheim, literally right next door to Disneyland. And so there were a lot of radio stations to choose from. I assumed, like little kids assume, that that was true all over the country and all over the world. It was only after I grew up and met kids from, like, you know, North Dakota, New Hampshire, and places like that in the 60s, 50s and 60s, there weren't that many radio stations. But in Southern California, we had lots to choose from. At the Disneyland Hotel, which was close to where I lived, they have a radio station there, and they had a glass window that opened into like a breezeway, walkway. So you could go and watch the DJ at work. I loved that. I just loved watching the DJ spin records. I loved listening to the radio, and I just got the, I want to say bug, but I'd like to have a better word. I got the attraction and the compulsion to listen to records at a really early age.
So is there any particular music genre or style or something that you remember as a little kid that you were like, oh my God, I like it just, you know, gave you chills kind of thing?
Yeah, I think I was like all little kids do, you try to, I think, follow the crowd for the most part until you find that they're going somewhere that you don't necessarily want to go or that just doesn't quite feel right. So when I was really young, I'm talking like 6, 7, 8 years old, the Beatles were really popular. So it was mostly the Beatles and the Beach Boys. And when it came to the Beatles, most of my friends were into them. I liked the Beatles, but it was when I saw the Rolling Stones on the Ed Sullivan show, I realized, yeah, I think this is a little bit closer to the street where I live. And then the record that really lit up my world was Papa's Got a Brand New Bag by James Brown. You know, it came out just when I was about to turn 9 years old. My cousin and an older cousin came over the house, and he brought his 45s, and he had that record with him. And we put that on the stereo and danced to it. And I just remember thinking, as a little kid thinks, now this is the shit. I had an affinity for R&B, soul, or blues-based music more than the popular music of the day, which tended to follow the rock dynamic of a small verse and then a big chorus and then a small verse and a great big chorus. And, you know, that dynamic that goes up and down. I much preferred the dynamic of R&B, which would just get in a groove and just hold it. The motion that I enjoy most to music is a more front to back kind of motion or a side to side motion more than the up and down, kind of up and down pogo stick dance that you do to rock music. I just think it's in the body. I think it's in our unique physiology for all of us, the origin of the music that we like.
So interesting, because there's a question I wanted to ask you as an expert in psychoacoustics. Is there,
and I have this conversation with my boyfriend a lot. So we're both kind of children of the 80s, and those were our formative years. He's a little earlier than me, but basically, you know, early 80s throughout the 80s. And is there a way to really be objective or unbiased about music in the sense of, you know, how everyone is like, oh, music wasn't as good as it was when I was a teenager? And is that because we were forming, you know, these like audio or neural pathways at the time, and so music sort of hit like certain, I don't know, like like dopamine releases that mm-hmm. render us completely incapable of hearing, you know, a song from our youth without having that attendant thrill. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The study of affective neuroscience looks at things like that, why we bond to caregivers, why we like what we like. It all starts in our youth. We all have these drives, these innate drives to seek out rewards. And the basic ones, the obvious ones, of course, are our food and shelter and all that. But once we've got our food and we've got our shelter, we're looking for things that make our idle brains in their leisure time happy. We're looking for our happy place. And when we're little kids, we do a lot of daydreaming. We feel so good. You know, it feels so good to stare at the back of that cereal box while you're having breakfast. It feels so good to stare at the pattern in your, maybe your bedspread or your poster in your room, and just let your mind drift and wander. So we start to have these avenues, these tracks, these neural tracks that are seeking rewards and are looking for stimuli that help and assist those rewards. In our environment, we're hearing music all the time, more so today than ever before, but the radio is always there, television programs and movies and entertainment generally features music. So when we are having a good time, when something is just lighting up our world, if the soundtrack feels right and appropriate, if it scratches the right itch for us, we'll bond to that. And what that means is that as we get older, when we're seeking out something that feels good or that musically tastes good, we're going to start there. We're going to go looking at what we think is, that's our music. That's my jam. So these pathways, we begin to set them down in childhood, but you had asked, can people be objective? Well, yeah. If you have some formal musical training, you can learn to regard music according to its rules and how well it's obeying or violating those rules. Music has a grammar and a syntax. And just like if you've studied oratory or rhetoric or anything like that in college, you can read a good debate. You can listen to a good speech, and you can say objectively whether or not that work hit the marks objectively, but whether or not that speech moved you, whether it motivated and inspired you, something altogether different. So yeah, you can, especially with some formal training, assess music objectively, but when it comes to our response to it, our emotional and physiological response to it, it's pretty automatic. You can't force people to like something that just doesn't feel right to them. I think a really good parallel is with food. You know, when we're little kids, we develop a taste for a certain amount of salt, a certain amount of spice, a certain amount of sugar. We develop these appetites. We like certain textures more than others. And as we get older, our tastes grow from there. We can learn to like new foods, but if you don't like spicy food or if you don't like sweets, you'll probably be that way for most of your life. You're going to seek out the food that is right for you.
Wow, that's so fascinating. Well, let's get back to your amazing story. So walk me through, you're a teenager in high school, your friends are starting to look at colleges or post-grad stuff. Where was your head at? Where were you kind of looking What was going on with you?
Well, I certainly didn't have any friends who were going to college. I grew up in Southern California from a working class family. And unfortunately, our mother, my mom, and I have siblings, three younger brothers, got sick, very sick when we were young. So by the time she finally passed away when I was 14 years old of her illness, there was no money. So college was simply not an option for my brothers and me. It just was never going to happen. We were going to go straight into the working world and get whatever job we could get. But I chose a different route. I chose, this was unfortunate, but I chose marriage. I was 17 and the guy I married was 21, and it seemed like, okay, I guess, you know, adulthood starts now. So I dropped out of high school and I got married. That ended up being, well, it was pretty awful at the time, but it ended up being a good thing because it turns out the person I married actually was really abusive, really physically abusive. He used to beat me up.
Wow.
Yeah. And that, in hindsight, I saw that that was actually a good thing because it gave me a free pass to get away from him without any regrets. Now, if I had married a really good man, I might never have had a music career, but I married a really bad man. And I think on some level, people, when they choose a partner, kind of know what they're doing. I wasn't ready for the right one, so I kind of chose the wrong one. Just to get me from age 17 to 21, I escaped at age 21, literally, and moved to Hollywood with a roommate. A friend I worked with, and we got an apartment in Hollywood, and I began my career just right then. I knew that I had been crazy about records since I was a kid, but I could also tell that being an artist had no appeal to me whatsoever. Like, it just didn't feel like the kind of thing I wanted to do or would be good at. I had zero interest in being a record executive. I didn't think I'd be good at that either. But one thing I kind of knew deep down inside that I could do is I'm good at studying. I've got an engineering type mind. I didn't know what audio engineering was, but I knew that if you give me textbooks and you give me a task that is mechanical in nature, I can handle that. And that instinct for the kind of thinker I was and am, the instinct for the kind of brain I had ended up serving me really, really well. It led me down the right path for me so that when I got my first break in the industry, I could do well at it. That's a really important thing for beginners to understand, the distinction between what you want and what you're capable of doing. You got to look at the Venn diagram where those two things overlap. So I wanted to be where records were being made. I realized that I could probably do some type of engineering. I started studying electronics on my own. I couldn't even really afford books, but the U.S. Army sent me their electronics manuals for free, just for the cost of postage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a friend told me, yeah, they said the U.S. Army has great electronics manuals. Call them. Tell them you're going to join the Army and tell them you want your electronics book so you can get started early. So I did. I called the local Army recruiter and I said, I'm 16 and I'm going to join the Army. Can you send me the books? And the guy says, yeah, sure, little lady. Send me $1.75 in postage and I'll send you our Army manual for electronics. And he did. I still have them. So yeah, when those arrived, I just started studying basic electronics. Then I bought books on modern recording techniques. I still have that book too. And basic acoustics and principles of electromagnetism, things like that. I studied and I was fortunate to get a job at a company called Audio Industries Corporation. They were on La Brea in Hollywood, right across from A&M Studios. They're no longer there, but they sold and serviced MCI consoles and tape machines. So they put me to work as a junior technician, taught me everything, and put me to work. I was repairing consoles and tape machines in the greater Los Angeles area from the age of about 22 for the next 3 years or so.
Did you, because I'm still amazed at your sort of your gumption and your grit at that age, especially coming from, you had some trauma to be sure. What do you think gave you kind of the drive to pursue this? And because you sound very you were very focused and you were very determined.
Yeah, it's interesting. I haven't read much about it, but when children experience illness and death early in their young lives, I think they grow up to be adults who don't take life for granted. I realized that my poor mother, she was only 50 years old when she died, and she didn't smoke or drink or have any bad habits. She was a wonderful woman, but she got cancer, and it had its way with her. So when I was finally an adult and could have a life of my own, I just was really determined to use that life and do the best I could with it and enjoy myself. I wanted what I wanted. What I wanted was to be where records were being made. So I just was determined that I didn't know whether or not I'd make it, but I knew I was going to try. I was going to try as hard as I possibly could and just see how far I'd get. And that was always my attitude. I didn't have really strong, clear goals. In fact, I advise students today not to. I like how I have a friend who's a sculptor. His name is Tim Bruckner, and Tim says, the future is a big place. You can't see it all from here. You're walking into the fog. All of us are. I think it's more important to be to have a light inside you than to have an external light. The light that's inside you is going to be a better guide for you than any prize or goal or target that you have assigned to yourself. When you walk into that fog, you just don't know if you're going to be able to hit that target or not. But if you walk into that fog knowing the kind of thinker you are, knowing what you want, knowing the kind of working environment that makes you happy, and we can talk about that, but by that I mean, are you an introvert or are you an extrovert? Do you do your best thinking when you're with other people and you're collaborating on an idea, or are you one of those people who does your best thinking when they put you alone in a room and shut the door? You know, knowing yourself as a thinker and knowing what you want, that allows you to put yourself in a position where you will be successful in that particular gig. That's always served me well my whole life.
I'm reminded of that quote of just the headlights. You know, you can't see. You can only see as far as the headlights in the car will show you, just 10 feet ahead. And that's it. So, yeah, I love that. So let's continue. So you're fixing consoles and tape machines, and then what?
I was with them for about 3 years, but there was a studio up the street that was owned by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It was called Rudy Records. Really, technically, it was called Rudy Records. Great studio, right in Crossroads of the World in Hollywood. And I would go on service calls there, and they would ask me, are you sure you don't want to leave your job and join us full time?
Wow.
And eventually, one day, I said yes. So that was my second job in the business. I was with Rudy for about 2.5 years, and I got to see kind of the West Coast crew. Many of them were featured in that recent movie Laurel Canyon on Epic. Folks like Bonnie Raitt and members of the Eagles and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, of course. And we had Art Garfunkel come by and Jackson Browne and just folks like that in this studio. Every now and then I would assist on sessions when our regular assistant was busy, but mostly my job was to keep the studio running. It was a great gig for me. They treated me well, and I was happy there, but I was still young. I was just early in my career, and primarily the music that I loved the most was the R&B soul-based music that I listened to on radio, and the records that I bought were soul records. I was working with Crosby, Stills, and Nash during the day, but coming home to my apartment at night and listening to Parliament Funkadelic and just those kind of funk soul records. My favorite artist in the world, my number one, was Prince. My friends knew I was a huge Prince fan. And then one very fateful day in the summer of 83, I got a phone call from a former boyfriend, John Sacchetti was his name. He worked at Westlake Audio. He was their chief tech. And he called me, and he was from Boston, so he had that thick Boston accent. He says, "So your dream job is waiting for you, Sue. So call Glenn. Prince is looking for a technician. Call Glenn. Call him." Glenn,
oh, my God.
Yeah, Glenn was Glenn Phoenix, who is the president and founder of Westlake. And Prince's people had reached out to Glenn asking if he knew a technician who'd want to leave LA, move to Minnesota, be the full-time tech for this guy, Prince. So Prince was just coming off the 1999 tour. He had signed a deal for the movie Purple Rain. He'd already started recording for the movie Purple Rain and for the next album, and he needed to upgrade his home studio. He needed a full-time technician who really knew audio and would be facile in working not just in audio, but would know enough to be able to work on films or to be able to work on videos, all the stuff that he needed doing at that time. So his management asked Westlake, and Westlake, Glenn Phoenix, went back to his crew in the tech room at Westlake, and he says, "You guys know anybody who's qualified and would want to work for this guy? What's his name? Prince?" Most people hadn't heard of him still at this point. Now John right away says, "Yeah, Sue, my ex-girlfriend, she'd want this job. This is her job."
You do that accent frighteningly well.
Yeah, that's it. John's from Quincy. And he and I are still in touch. Anyway, as soon as he told me, I said, "Well, you tell Glenn that search is over, because that is my gig. I'm getting that job." And I did. His management interviewed me, and we agreed on a salary, and they said, "All right, pack your bags, off you go." And I did. And I shipped off to Minnesota, where I did not know a soul. I had just turned 27. I am now the technician for this guy who is poised to become a superstar, although not everyone realized that at that time, because I'd been his fan for a long time and had seen his meteoric rise. I recognized that this was the opportunity of a lifetime, so I embraced it with all the fear and trepidation that I had. I just kept the attitude of, this job is going to be my job for every single day I can manage to not screw up and keep this my job. And I was with him over 4 years.
So you didn't meet him in LA. His management interviewed you, and then you didn't meet him until you got to Minneapolis?
Right. I didn't meet him until after they had hired me.
Did you experience any of the, you know, being a woman working in this industry, did you experience any, you know, sexism or difficulties or things like that?
Well, it was, that was kind of a two-lane highway, really. There were folks, especially some older men, who looked at me with the hairy eyeball when I would show up with my toolkit, my oscilloscope, my parts box to repair their console that they just paid $500,000 for, their tape machine. And they would look at me like, "What the hell is this?" Because some of those older guys had never seen a female technician, much less a young female technician.
Right.
So there was hesitation and doubt. That's the one lane of the highway. But the other lane of the highway was all the men who believed in me. The folks who hired me at Audio Industries, the guys who hired me at Rudy Records, Prince, of course, the men who looked at me and went, "No, she's perfect. She'll be fine. She's got the same brain they have, and she's really eager and motivated to do this. Let's give her a shot." And it's those folks who gave me that shot. Those were the folks I worked for. For the others with the raised hairy eyebrow, well, when you're a technician, there's no subjective analysis. The tape machine or the console's either fixed or it isn't. The electrons don't give a shit what, you know, what kind of pants you're wearing, to paraphrase Marissa Tomei in that movie, My Cousin Vinny. They don't care. You just repair it or you don't. And as long as I knew my stuff, and I did, I had the confidence of knowing that what matters in this job is accomplishment. And if I accomplish things, then I'm good. And that's what I did. So yeah, it was always there, but I never fell prey to it. I never let myself be caught in its jaws.
And I remember reading in an interview that you said that Prince surrounded himself with women and he considered them his equal. You know, there was never a case where you felt like he's the guy and I'm the subservient.
Yeah, he was so great in that way. He, being a fellow who had pulled himself up by his own bootstraps in his youth, he recognized motive and drive in other people. He recognized the kind of ambition that is tied to accomplishment, not the ambition that is tied to awards or accolades, but the kind, he and I shared that, as did other people on his crew. We wanted to do something. We wanted to be part of something that would leave a mark. And when he found those people and put us in those jobs, he would give us an instruction or a responsibility and walk away and let us take that. Let us have that. I can't tell you how good that feels, to be respected that way, to be given something to do that is important and difficult, and being told, you got this, or not in those words, but the sense of it was, I trust you. So yeah, just let me know if you have trouble, but I trust you. This is yours. That's a wonderful feeling. He was like that.
So you're originally supposed to be fixing consoles, but you became very involved in production. Do you want to talk about that evolution?
Yeah, when Prince hired me, he hired a technician and he got what he hired. I did technical work for him initially, but Prince did not recognize, or more likely he did not care, about the difference between a technician's job and an engineer's job. So my job was to make the equipment work, but my job was not using the equipment. Engineers, especially in the days of analog tape, were artists. You had to really know what you were doing artistically because the tape transfer function was nonlinear. But anyway, he didn't care. And as soon as I did the tech work and had his equipment up and running in his home studio, this was well before Paisley Park was built, he just put me in the engineering chair because he expected me to use the equipment. So that's how I transitioned from being a tech into being an engineer for him. When we finished the Purple Rain album and the movie and we went out on the Purple Rain tour, I was on the road primarily as a recording engineer, and we hired another technician, the great Sal Greco. We hired Sal Greco away from Electric Lady. Sal was a better tech than I was, still is. He's a lifelong technician, and Sal became Prince's tech, and I became Prince's engineer. He's a full-time engineer. After I left Prince, I moved back to L.A. in 1988. The work I did for the next few years was engineering, occasionally mixing. Every now and then I'd be asked to mix a record. And then eventually, as what usually happens with experienced engineers, the label will ask you, would you co-produce this record with this band? They don't really want a producer. They want to produce themselves, but we don't want them to produce it all by themselves. So would you co-produce it with them? You do that a few times, and that is not fun. Co-production is not at all fun. It's like two people driving a car, you know, with one taking the pedals and the other one taking the wheel. So after you've done that a couple of times, you say, no more co-production. I want production credit if I'm going to do this. And that's how I transitioned. I never did do a record where I produced it and did not engineer it. So the production that I did happened concurrently with the engineering that I was doing on records. That worked out for me in the days of analog, but it would be, if I were to produce a record today, I'd need someone to operate Pro Tools for me because I haven't worked in the digital medium.
Would you consider yourself an artist, like when you were working with Prince?
Well, there are people who, all people who become technically proficient enough can have the capacity to turn that into an art. So I make the distinction with my students between art and craft. We all start as craftspeople. We learn whether it's how to play or how to be a surgeon or how to repair a tape machine or how to sing. We learn the basic fundamentals of our craft. But once you've mastered your craft and your body knows what movements to make to be an expert with that device that you're using, at that point, your original ideas can be made manifest because you know how to push paint around on canvas, or you know how to push faders around or dial in a compressor. So yeah, I think my my craftsmanship as an engineer reached a point where I was so facile with the equipment that I could express my original ideas. In other words, I had a sound. And not every engineer reaches that point, but many of us do. I think the majority of us, if we hang in there long enough, will have a sound. And that makes us unique. That makes us an artist. Now, if you're mixing, you have to be an artist. Pure craftsmanship alone is not going to get you a great mix. So the more mixing I did, the more of an artist I became. And then when you're producing, that's what they're hiring you for. They're hiring you for your original thought, for your ideas. You have to bring that to the table. So I did. I'm not as pure of an artist as others, but I learned when I transitioned from the music business to neuroscience that it's the same brain. Neuroscience is a lot like an engineering mind. You're thinking about systems and how the parts interconnect and how, well, thinking is an emergent property of a very complex neural system, just like music is an emergent property of some complex goings on in a lot of different circuits. But in order to really make a contribution to the field, you have to be able to bring some original thought to the table, I think, in any profession.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, too, because I've read in your interviews, you know, you got maybe 4 hours of sleep and, like, the ability to brush your teeth before Prince would snag you for another recording. And, I mean, you put in your 10,000 hours. It sounds like, you know, I do sort of wonder, well, not wonder, I think I basically subscribe to that there is sort of this need to have a 10,000 hours in your craft in order to evolve it into what you're describing of using it in an artistic way where it's literally like using your hands or
yes,
just innate.
Yes, studies of talent have looked at that, and what people have labeled as talent has been found to be the product of some objective factors, namely the number of hours of practice. And in addition to that, like musical talent, for example, it requires not necessarily a high IQ, but it does require a slightly larger than average working auditory memory capacity. And then it requires the personality traits of delayed gratification, for example, the capacity to know that I need to do this for years before I'll be any good at it. So you have to have self-discipline. You have to have a capacity to focus and to pay attention. So all these personality traits coupled with, you know, maybe one or two biological traits, and then the number of hours that you put in, all of that, the sum of all of that is what we label in society as talent. Certainly Prince put in those hours when he was a child. It breaks my heart to think of how lonely that kid must have been when he was a child and a teenager. He was working all by himself. In some cases, in his teens, his early teens, when he lived with his mom and his fairly evil stepdad, he was locked up, literally locked in a bedroom. He had his musical instruments, and he did nothing but play and learn to play and write and sing all on his own.
The other thing I wanted to just ask you about, what you basically have already answered, is I love the fact that you talk about it being an art form and mixing as an art form. I think there's a pressure today that, especially with the home studios and the DAWs, that you can do everything. And so from soup to nuts, you create, you produce, you lay the tracks, you do the vocals, then you mix and you master. And I really can't mix or master for shit. And I think it's a blessing because, again, I need other artists. Like, I am a solo artist, but I need other artists, especially, I think, when it comes to listening. And I think, and I'm sure you can talk about this, but I lose the ability to hear after a certain point of repetition, of hearing the same tracks or the same songs over and over, that I've lost the ability to sort of discern certain things or to bring out certain things. And I need that second set of ears that's trained to basically be able to pick out it and seek out. So I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yes, I think you're 100% correct about that, about one, having more than, as Spinal Tap would say, more than one mind on it. Or maybe that's the trogs. But yeah, we need that. And also your point about not trying to be an expert in everything. And this is what I tell students. For myself and for all the people I know, every single one of them who has become hugely successful, every single one of us added our skill set in series, not in parallel. If you take Greg Kurstin, for example, Greg Kurstin has won Grammys a couple of times for Producer of the Year for his work with Adele and so many other people, Sia, Lily Allen. But when I knew Greg, when I met him and worked with him when he was 23 years old, he was an expert musician, expert on piano. He added guitar. He became really exceptional on guitar. After the band Gegita broke up, he added the skills of co-writing. He added the skills of arranging. And now when you look at Greg's credits on records that he works on, you will often see that he mixes and engineers and produces and plays every instrument on many of the records that he does. He added these skills in series. What we need to do as young people is determine for others that we can become world-class great at something. Once you've shown that you have what it takes to be world-class great at something, be it performing or mixing or engineering, whatever, the world will give you opportunities to branch out from that skill set. But first you have to show that you can be competitively great. In my own case, you know, starting as a technician, becoming an engineer, becoming a mixer, becoming a producer, and then parlaying that into the opportunity to become a scientist. Adding those in series, I never would have been able to add them in parallel. And the thing you say about listening with another set of ears is so very true. Many years ago, I was doing a live on-air interview, and the interviewer said to me, now, this was years ago when Prince was alive, they said, Prince has commented on something you said many years before that in another interview. And what Prince said was, Susan Rogers doesn't know my music. Nobody knows my music except me. And the interviewer asked me, what would you say to that? And I had to think really quickly because it was a live interview. But I said, well, in one way, he's 100% right. But in another way, he's 100% wrong. The creator of something knows two data points, the data point of intention and the data point of execution. You know what you tried to do, and you know how it turned out. Everyone else in the world only has that one data point, how it turned out, the execution. They don't know what you tried to do, so they don't know whether or not you're disappointed in it or happy with it. So when someone else listens to your music, they're listening to it devoid of having to walk that line back and forth between what you tried to do and how it turned out. They're just standing in one spot listening to it. And that's a viewpoint that no creator can ever possibly have. You can never possibly cut off that bridge in between what you tried to do and how something turned out. Although people can get pretty good at minimizing that bridge, you never get rid of it completely. So yeah, other people are always going to hear music through a filter that doesn't include the same emotion that we bring to it. And they're also going to listen to our music through that filter of, like we started talking about, their own unique appetite. What is too much salt for one person's taste is not enough salt for another person's taste. So they're going to be listening to our music, and they're going to be doing what's been called epistemic foraging. They're going to be doing a mental foraging to listen for those elements that they personally like, for the rhythm that they like, for the chord changes that they like, for the melody that they like, for the lyrical approach that they like, for the timbres that they like. We're scanning for rewards. If we find it, we go, yeah, it's pretty good. And if we don't find it, we might say something like, yeah, it's good, but it's not really my style.
You're reminding me of an amazing story I heard. if you know the song Closing Time by Semisonic, it was written by Dan Wilson. And ostensibly, the lyrics, it's closing time at the bar. Lights are on, everybody's go home. And he had written that song about the birth of his first child.
Aww.
Because it was closing time to the party life that he had known, and the sort of carefree, independent, not having to think or worry about anyone else kind of life. And this woman commented that she had lost her daughter, and that song had come on the radio, and it brought her such peace.
Oh, wow.
And it was like, here's a song he wrote about life. She was experiencing a death, and yet the song touched her in ways that he would have never have predicted or realized. And I think that's sort of the artist's blessing and curse, is like, once you put something out into the world, it's no longer yours. And it's no longer yours to say, well, that song is supposed to be about X, and you can't say that it's about Y because I wrote it about X.
Right. Yes. I'm writing a book right now with a co-author. We signed in February to W.W. Norton Publishing.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Great.
Yeah, we're in the middle of writing a book, but that's exactly our topic. We're writing about listening to music. It's not about music per se. It's not about making music. It's about the vantage point of the listener, that's someone I've been my whole life. My artistry, musical artistry that I have, such that I have it, is as a listener. I'm really good at listening to music. And the first few times I said that, I felt embarrassed to say that, oh, I'm really good at listening to music. Like, how hard is that? But if you really dissect it, it's listening to music is, for many of us, our form of musical expression. So you take this record in, and if you like that record, it becomes you, becomes the music of you in one way or another. And what that is saying is that other people's music can sometimes, in some cases, excite our own resonant frequencies in the same pattern or the same way that it excited the creator, the person who created this piece of music. We can see things from the same point of view or from a different point of view, but we can experience something that each of us, deep in our psyches, both the creator of a musical work and the consumer of it, can recognize, yeah, that's true. What you said is true. That's how it should go. I think in the world of music, we can probably honestly say that only a small portion of it is going to be the music of us. Now, I tell students all the time that there's a huge difference between the reaction in your listener that goes, yeah, that's pretty good, I like that, and the reaction that says, I want that, I need that. All the time, at least every time I have a class with students, I'll hear a piece of music that I think is objectively good, and I think it's good. I tell the student that's really good. That's very clever, very smart, it's very well done. There's no way that piece of music is going to make it into rotation in my iTunes library. But every now and then, and this is somewhat rare, a student will play something, and I get that reaction of, I want this. I need this. I am going to listen to this piece of music over and over again. When that happens, now you've sold concert tickets. Now you've sold t-shirts. Now you've got fans on your mailing list. That want, that need, that reaction is the one that gives you a career. If you can get that reaction from people through your music, you have a career.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And I remember reading, and I love that you said this, that you were saying there's three kinds of audiences. There was the general public, there was the music critic, and then there were other musicians. And all three are going to hear your song differently. And I love that, because I think as myself as a musician, like I think we sometimes get into circle jerks with other musicians where you're kind of in either this echo chamber or this like competitive rat race kind of thing, and in which the audience, the general public, is sort of secondary and you're trying to impress other musicians.
Yes, we were talking, it was Tommy Jordan and Greg Kirsten and myself, and they were the band Gagita, and this was back in the 90s, and we were having lunch at Tommy's house. Tommy's house was where we recorded, and it was out in Pomona. And we're talking about the Triple Crown. And the Triple Crown is an artist who manages to be at the top of these three audiences' lists or favors at the same point in time. And that would be the critics and scholars. And the second audience would be your peers, other musicians. And the third audience is the general public. Because those three audiences all are seeking different rewards from music, they all have a different value system. So it's really hard to wear the Triple Crown. Greg Kirsten came up with a really good one that was pretty undeniable, and that was Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington in the 40s was huge with the general public. He was America's most popular, or one of the most popular band leaders. The critics thought he could do no wrong, and other musicians thought he was a god. But that's really hard to do. Prince wore the Triple Crown very briefly for the Purple Rain album. But anyway, we were talking about that. And a sports analogy is useful. A fan in the seats at a baseball game is going to watch the game differently than another baseball player who might be sitting in those seats right next to you, a professional baseball player. That baseball player, the professional, is going to see things that the fan is going to miss. And then you've got Las Vegas and you've got the bookies who are going to be watching for something different in that baseball game. So that's three different perspectives on how this game is going. Same thing with music. The public is going to be listening for, how does it make me feel? And can I dance to it? And does it have a catchy hook? And do I like it? Is it appealing? Is it appetizing? Is it rewarding? The other musicians are going to be looking for cleverness. Is this an artist whose work I'd like to emulate? Is this somebody who knows things that I don't know and has ideas I'd like to steal from? And then, of course, the critics and scholars are listening for whether or not this work represents ideas whose time has come. Would we like to hear more of this or not? Or is this old hat? Is it cliched? Is it tired? So they're all looking at it through a different lens. And it's important for record makers, especially producers, to recognize when you're making music. You have to find your audience and stick with your audience. Don't try to please everyone or you end up with music that is as bland as water.
That's so powerful and I think very necessary to hear right now, especially when I think of Spotify. They want to curate ambient music versus individual artists kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, music has a form and it has a function. And for many, many listeners, I'm not one of them, but for many, many listeners, music's function is to be a background. It's to serve as a just kind of a soundtrack to other main activities. I'm old enough and also of the type that I regarded music listening as an activity in and of itself. In my generation, when music wasn't portable, you'd have to put a record on, you'd have to sit in front of the speakers if you were going to listen to it, but that's what you did. You went to other people's houses when you're a kid to listen to music. That was an activity. We're going to put it on, we're going to listen to it. So active listening was rewarded by certain kinds of musical gestures, by more complex forms and by more complex lyrics and little hidden pieces of ear candy and ornamentation. All of that was designed, and I should add to that dynamics. All of that was designed to reward the active listener who was consuming this as a standalone activity. Many listeners today, however, prefer to listen to music passively, and those exact same gestures actually work against passive listening. Dynamic changes that wake you up are annoying if you don't want to be woken up. I don't mean literally woken up from sleep. I mean having your nervous system distracted by music. Mm. That's annoying if you're using music as to jog to or to while you work, let's say, at home. Those dynamic changes, those intense, important lyric changes can be really annoying or can be missed entirely if you're a passive listener. So the function of music is always changing. And again, record makers need to keep that in mind as they make their record. How is this going to be useful to someone in his or her life?
Hmm, that's great. Well, let's continue on your journey. What made you decide to go into academia and become a scientist?
Well, I started feeling the call, the inner drive toward just curiosity about the natural world. The same brain that had applied itself to learning electronics and acoustics, that same brain that loved studying was still active, and it wanted to be active. It wanted to study things and learn things. And the thing I was most curious about was consciousness and intelligence in other species. I wanted to be a cognitive ethologist and work with non-human animals. But because I started my career late, it was suggested to me by an advisor, and when I was an undergrad, this advisor said, you know, you're starting your career late. By the time you get your PhD, you're going to be 52 years old. It would be wise for you to work in this new field of music perception and cognition, because you can make, you can bring your virtual PhD to the table and you can make a unique contribution. It wasn't what I wanted, but I recognized it was the smart move. So for the first time in my life, I did something that wasn't exactly what I wanted. And I got into music perception and cognition. It was the right move for me. I've been rewarded by working in this field. It also allowed me to now teach in my current profession. I teach music production and engineering at Berklee College of Music in Boston. But I also teach psychoacoustics, and I have taught music cognition for our students as well. And that's really rewarding to be able to take those musicians and talk to them about the brain and the human music connection. And it's also nice to be able to foster the science interests of our young musicians on campus, because many of our young musicians on campus are intently interested in science. And it's nice to be able to plant that seed and to let them know, oh, you can definitely have both. Don't be thinking that if you're a musician, you can't also be a scientist. Most of the scientists I know are actually amateur musicians. The two go very well together.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. And I think, yeah, that stereotype of sort of either or has definitely been smashed. And myself, I mean, I just see it in terms of the marriage of tech and music, especially nowadays with electronic music and the massive interest in it that has risen, and the ability to produce at home, and things like that. In particular, I would love to see more women working with DAWs and producing. Are you starting to see that more in your classes? Or,
you know what, Ariel? It is so interesting. I've been at Berklee 12 years now, and our major, MP&E, Music Production and Engineering, where I teach, is a select major because each student is guaranteed X number of hours of studio time. We can only accept so many. So it's a competitive elite major at the college. For the 12 years that I've been there, the gender balance has remained the same. It's pretty much about 25%, sometimes as high as 40% female, who will be accepted into MP&E, but that acceptance rate is, it's actually higher for females than it is for males, because we want to see more women involved in music production and engineering. So we do put our thumb on the scale just a little bit in order to try and push it toward 50%. But you can't push what isn't there. And a lot of women are simply not interested in music production and engineering, and they don't apply. We'd love to see more. The women that we have, of course, are great. A brain is a brain, and the women and the gender non-binary and the folks, the transition folks that we have, I mean, they're all good. It's all the same. the same in that some are great and some are just okay and some have kind of chosen the wrong major. It's all the same. There's no gender difference in this profession in terms of the actual mechanism of actually making records and thinking about them. It's the same. But I've come to the conclusion after looking at this for 42 years now, this is a male-dominated profession, engineering and production, primarily because more men are interested in it than women are. Now, on the artistic side, I think it's closer to 50-50. There are just as many women artists as there are men, or gender non-binary, however you want to divide this up. But on the technical side, it tends to attract more men. Now, in part, I think this is because our society rewards men who have myopic focus on their careers. We see examples of men in movies and television programs, men who are applauded for working late at the office in order to bring home the bacon or put more food on the table. Children, say a prayer for your father. He's working late again tonight. But, oh, what a good dad. What a good husband. There he is. He's working morning, noon, and night. We never see him, but he's going to make life better for us. What a good man. Now think about the images we see of women who have myopic focus on their careers and aren't there to put dinner on the table or to tuck the kids into bed at night. That woman doesn't get the same societal rewards for working that focused on her career. And that's a shame. We need to reward those women who are never home because they're working so hard. The idea almost seems anathema. Like it almost seems like that is a wrong idea. Well, of course, human beings evolved. Men and women evolved our slightly different traits because males evolved to compete and to fight off the saber-toothed tiger, and to keep the family safe, and to be big and strong, and have lots of testosterone and big muscles. And women evolved to raise children, and to be gentle, and to be there for them, and to bond to them, and to make sure those children grow up and reach adulthood. So society is having to work against some biological norms. And we women have to, I think, acknowledge that society can change, but biology won't. It's still going to take us a minimum of 9 months to reproduce. A man can reproduce in 9 minutes or quite a bit less than that. It's the commitment that our bodies have to make to reproduction is huge compared to what a man has to make. A female notion of competitiveness. Sure, we're competitive. Look at the women athletes. We're hugely competitive. But in society, competing for jobs, getting in the ring with the world's best mixer or producer and saying, yeah, I'll take a shot at him. We women don't find that as naturally compelling as men do. So we have a different set of obstacles than men have, including the obstacle that we're not necessarily looked on favorably when we forego husbands and children in order to have a career. That's not necessarily considered a good thing for us, whereas it's considered, it's a great thing for a guy. So there's differences there.
I mean, in my own experience, just being out here with other women musicians, to me, being able to produce my own tracks is such freedom and independence from having a male producer sort of tell me what my song should sound like. And then obviously at the sort of extreme end of the spectrum, dealing with like skeevy scumbags in the industry that, you know, want sort of a transaction, usually physical for their labor kind of thing. So I want more women to learn DAWs, learn Logic. I personally am a Logic girl, but because I, like I said, there's such freedom in the knowledge and also just simply being able to, when you do mix and master, you know, when you're Nixer is talking about compression. You know what that's about. You know what EQ's about. You know what he's saying when he means a limiter and that type of thing. And it's just my fervent wish just for the sake of freedom and independence and really truly expressing your own artistic form to learn this. And again, as we had discussed before, we don't have to do everything. We don't have to mix and master and have the final track, but I just think knowledge is such power, especially in this industry.
Yes, you're right. Knowledge is power. And another thing we need to have happen is for men to stop wielding it like a club, stop holding it over women's heads and like it's some sort of prize. Like I'll share my power with you if you will sleep with me, or I'm going to hold on to all this power and not explain to you what a compressor is or the difference between a hall and a plate, or explain to you what I'm doing right now with the editing because you'd never understand it. I mean, that's just absolutely ridiculous. It doesn't serve anyone well. It doesn't serve women. It doesn't serve men. So I would really love to see, given that the numbers are what they are and that more men are in this profession than women, boy, wouldn't I love to see more men recognize women as equals and treat them as equals, treat them with the same respect that they would treat other guys. Now, a few years back here at Berkeley, we had Sylvia Massey come and visit us for a week. We often have visiting artists. So Sylvia was with us for a week and she lit the kids up. She's just so incredible. And the kids just couldn't stop talking about her because she's fabulous. She went to the classes and she had a session. And anyway, year or so, maybe 6 months later, she was going to be coming back for a second visit. And I was just finishing up a class and there were three guys who were kind of hanging out in the control room after the class. And they were talking very excitedly with one another. And I'm wrapping up and getting my paperwork. And I turned to look at them and the three of them looked at me and they said, you know, Sylvia Massey's coming back. And we were just talking about how excited we are because Sylvia's coming. And one of them said a sentence I will never forget. He looked at me and he said, Sylvia Massey is the greatest engineer in the world.
Wow.
I could have cried. I mean, yeah, I wanted to say, here's their three young faces. And I wanted to say to them, I never thought I'd hear that in my life. I never thought I would hear men, apropos of nothing, without there being a contest or a competition or just to please me, just say, because they believed it true, Sylvia Massey, a woman, is the greatest engineer in the world. This young generation, many of them, not all, but certainly I think the majority of them, are seeing women engineers and artists and beat programmers and songwriters. They're seeing producers and mixers. There are more and more out there. And they're recognizing how strong and capable these women are, and many of the youth of today, the young men of today, are recognizing, yeah, let's have everybody. I think there, many of them are thinking like Prince thought all those years ago. It's better when there are women in the room. It's better when we've got a mix. Let's bring it on. Let's make this happen.
Absolutely. I love that. Well, we're running out of time, but I wanted to just ask you if you could talk about real quick the Record Co., which just sounds so wonderful.
Oh, I'm afraid this part of the interview would be very boring. Yes, I'm no longer involved with them, and I haven't been since 2013.
Oh,
I
got okay.
A human resources at Berkeley and asked them to take that off my body. Bio. What happened was I was approached by a student. His name is Matt MacArthur, and this was in, I think, my second year at Berkeley, and he had this great idea for a nonprofit recording studio. What he needed was an expert's help in launching a recording studio, and I loved the idea, and so I rolled up my sleeves and got to work with him, and we did launch the Record Co., and it was successful. We parted ways in 2013 for a number of reasons. He wanted to run it on his own, independently, without kind of an adult in partnership with him. And also, it was really taking too much time away from my work and my research. So we parted company in 2013. And just recently, the building where it was located was repurposed. I think they lost their lease or something, because I see now it's going to be a shopping mall or something like that. So I don't know if it's moved or during the pandemic, if they've gone underground. I really don't know what's happening with it. But I'm I'm no longer involved. It was a great idea, though.
Yeah, and you were, well, you were part of the launch, and nobody can take that away from you. So that's great. And also, I love the idea of having accessible recording space. I just think that's so important. And that's another thing that, unfortunately, people can sort of feel like fall prey to $1,000 an hour type deals or whatever, where it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, Matt's brilliant idea was to recognize, and this is what he said in my office that got me fired up. He said, my generation doesn't need to own a recording studio. We just need access to a recording studio. So if we could give our community something in exchange for that access, maybe they would allow us to build a studio that we could all just kind of share at a price that would be affordable for young people. And he was absolutely right about that. So by becoming a 501c3, the nonprofit organization, the Record Co. was able to give music technology lessons to area youth during the day in exchange for a tax write-off and having reduced paying lower rents and having reduced overhead so that there could be so the studio could be affordable for all these Berklee grads. It worked really, really well for the first few years it was in operation. I don't know what Matt's done with it these days, but it was a really smart idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before we end, I just wanted to ask about your book. Do you have a release date? Do you have a title?
We have a tentative working title, which I'm keeping under my hat because it turns out I'm learning all about the publishing industry. And the publishing industry, they have the right to call it whatever they want to call it. So I don't know. We've got a working title that they like, but I don't know for sure if that's what it'll be. We're handing in the manuscript in August of next year, and we expect that it will be out maybe in the fall of 2021. We're in good shape. We're ahead of schedule a little bit, so I'm looking forward to having it be out there and talking about it and bringing non-musicians like myself into the conversation, bringing music listeners into the conversation of what music is. We don't have music without a listener. Music isn't music if it's playing to an empty room. It becomes music when these sound pressure waves are transduced in a brain that hear this signal as music. I don't know, is it music to a dog? I kind of doubt it. Is it music to a fish? I don't necessarily think so. It's a human brain that makes this particular type of acoustic pressure variations music. And when that happens, it can be magical, like the story you told about the woman and the song Closing Time. It can be a psychic truth that we hold down deep inside of us. Man, that is so beautiful when a group of talented people express themselves musically and someone else listens to it and says, that's me. You just expressed me. You expressed my life. Wow, is that great.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we have to end. I have chills. Thank you so much, Susan, for your time. I'm just absolutely thrilled that we got a chance to hear your story today.
Thank you, Ariel. And I really appreciate you having me on. And I want to congratulate all your listeners for having the good sense to listen to this podcast in community. That's where careers are made. It's where musical scenes are made. The importance of community can't be overstated.
Many, many thanks to Dr. Susan Rogers. Wow, that was just an incredible interview. And speaking of community, I am so thrilled that you are still here joining me on season 2 in 2020 with all the insanity that's going on. Just very, very grateful that you're here and listening to the podcast. Again, we can be found on all the streaming platforms. So please, if you are on one of those streaming platforms, if you could maybe give us a nice review or subscribe or just say hi, would love that. I'm also on social media. I'm l.ariel, and you can find me on Instagram or Twitter at L-A-R-I-E-L Music. The website is lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com. Once again, thanking you for being you and being here. Join us for our next episode coming up sooner or later. Again, take good care. Wishing you a wonderful week, a wonderful holiday weekend. And again, we are all going to just keep on hustling, pursuing that dream. And don't you give up.